They are coming to my office.
They do. That's my intention.
Mic's on.
Mic's on. All right. The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome to another eventful day in the life of the House Committee on Education. We strive here to keep you engaged and your email boxes full. Today we have three bills on the Oregon Educator Benefit Board, and then we will also be hearing House Bill 2939. We do not expect to get to House Bill 2939 until after 2 o'clock. So if you are here on House Bill 2939, it is going to be at least an hour before we take up that bill. And so with that, if you have a cell phone with you, please turn your cell phone all the way off, not just to silent. It interferes with the recording system, and that becomes our permanent record of the meeting. So please be considerate of those that are listening and turn the phone all the way off. Also, I know that many people in the room appear to have cameras. It's great to have a pictorial documentation of the committee, but flashes are really distracting. So if you could avoid using your flash, the members of the committee would be very appreciative of that. And with that, I will open an informational meeting on the Oregon Educator Benefit Board. Denise Hall, please. Welcome, and if you could begin by stating your name for the record, that would be very helpful, please.
Right. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the House Committee on Education, for the record, my name is Denise Hall. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. On behalf of the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, I'd like to thank you for inviting me here today to tell you a little more information about the OEB, or Oregon Education's Benefit Board.
Ms. Hall, can you pull the microphone closer. A little closer?
Maybe Thanks. Up a little?
Yes.
Okay. The Oregon Educators Benefit Board, or OEB, was created by Senate Bill 426 in 2007. It was created under the Department of Administrative Services and charged with designing, implementing, and administering a benefits program for school districts, education service districts, and community colleges. And it needs to provide a high-quality benefits at the very lowest possible cost. The legislation required OEB to implement the benefits program by no later than October 1st of 2008. OEB implemented and had a benefits of, program available to school districts, education service districts, and community colleges on October 1st. During the 2007 legislative session, it was estimated that OEB, the creation of OEB, would actually generate about 5% administrative savings at full implementation, which would be in October of 2010, and that is estimated to be approximately $40 million. One of the first official duties that the board had was to go out and get a consultant group to help implement and design the benefits program. OEB retained Watson Wyatt, an actuarial and health benefits firm, to help them with that task. Watson Wyatt gathered and analyzed data from school districts throughout the state, education service districts as well, and they helped the board create the 9 medical plans, 4 pharmacy options, 8 dental plans, and 5 vision plans that are currently available to districts throughout the state of Oregon. OEB's medical plan designs include no costs for preventive services, including routine physicals, mammograms, well-child visits. So that's one of the premier services on our plans is the low-cost or no-cost preventive services. After we created those plans, we released those to bid in early 2008, and we had 30 proposals from vendors wishing to offer the plans available through OEB. The board, Watson Wyatt, initially scored those proposals, and then a subcommittee of 7 of the 10 board members actually interviewed and scored the remaining portions of the proposal, and they selected the vendors that would provide those coverages to school district employees. On April 24th, 2008, the board announced that Kaiser Permanente, ODS Health Plan, Providence Health Plan, and Willamette Dental would offer those benefit programs to the district employees. And then we released the final carrier and rate information in May. We allowed districts to look at the plan options available and select up to 4 medical plans with a pharmacy option, up to 3 dental programs, and up to 2 vision programs to offer to each employee group. Employee groups are, for example, the classified employees at a district would be one group, where the licensed employees would be another group. And then OEB staff and representatives from the carriers traveled throughout the state of Oregon, both during the plan selection process as well as the open enrollment period that was held from August 15th through September 15th, to explain the plans that were available to the employees and make sure that they had their questions answered as they selected their plans. Initially, we anticipated about 22,000 employees and their dependents to come onto the program in 2008. A lot of things changed, and we actually enrolled nearly 65,000 employees and upward of 147,000 with their dependents. So we were much larger the first year than we had anticipated. As a result of that higher than anticipated enrollment, we did collect additional administrative fee that we had not projected to collect, and we were able to repay the nearly $5 million general fund loan that we received under Senate Bill 426. We repaid that this biennium. The due date was actually by June 30th of 2011, so we were happy to be able to pay that early. And one of the reasons, main reasons, that we were able to handle that higher than expected enrollment in the first year is the fact that we created an electronic online benefit management and application system. So employees were able to enroll in the program online via the web for their program. About 98% of the members enrolled online by the September 15th deadline. So that was nothing short of miraculous in our eyes. Following initial enrollment, Watson Wyatt calculated the savings for the first year, and they estimated the first year savings of about 4.8%, or just over $37 million. The board is now moving toward offering the other benefits that will be available under the bill, the optional benefits. They voted to start the long-term care coverage, which actually is an optional. They have to provide that at some point in the future. It will be offered in 2010. And starting October 1st of 2009, we'll offer life, disability, and accidental death and dismemberment coverage to district employees. We estimate that that will save about $6.3 million, with about two-thirds of that being realized by districts, the other third by employees that go into the program voluntarily, and it represents about a 30% savings overall on those premiums. We're also preparing to assist the task force that was created during in Senate Bill 426, and we expect the task force findings will be due to the interim committee in 2012. So we're trying to get things together so we can assist that task force in any way possible. Again, I'd like to thank you for inviting me here to talk about OEB, and if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer those.
Thank you very much. Representative Norman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. On the information that you provided, I am happy to hear that it works like we thought it would. But one of the questions I have is relative to who the bidders were. And living in Hood River, I don't have access to Kaiser, and I don't have access to a Providence health plan because living in Hood River. Districts outside of the service areas of these, is there a product for them?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman. Actually, Providence Health Plan is a statewide offering, and they are available, plans 1 and 2, throughout the state, including Hood River.
Oh, great. Thank you.
So it is.
Are there further questions?
Yeah.
Representative
Maurer? Oh, sorry. Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair. I've been highly critical of OEB and because I thought that the savings would not be realized, and over the last year we had a local school district that went through the throes of being pulled in and then were exempted out for a year. But the cost wasn't going to be realized by the state or the school district. It was going to be realized by the employees themselves because the district had a cap. And so in this, I mean, clearly there have been some winners. My understanding is community colleges that are in have won, which, you know, and the winners are a great thing. And so I'm interested in all these bills, which I'm looking forward to the conversation. But PEB, just last month, voted to go self-insured. And I know OEB and PEB are close, and they have the same administrative structure, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Moore, yes.
Okay, so they are familiar with each other. Is there any talk about OEB becoming self-insured?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, there has been talk from the beginning. At this point in time, we have no fund and funding mechanism to be self-insured. Our stabilization fund doesn't have any balance in there. So they'll be looking at ways to potentially build that at some point in the future, but that has not happened at this time.
And follow up, why would the PEB stabilization fund not help you in self-insuring, or at least offering a self-insured plan?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, the funds are actually separate. We're under a separate program and accept separate authority for spending in those funds.
Okay.
So we're separate.
Representative Rublin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thanks. My wife is an employee of a school district, and we went online, and she got all the stuff signed up, and I was more than impressed. And personally, since I worked very hard on this bill, I was very pleased that things went as well as they did. You know, at the first, there were little fits and starts about who got the contracts and all this other kind of stuff, but over the last year or so, all of that's gone away, and the districts that I am involved with who are in it all have felt that they have realized some, at least a slowing down of insurance costs, if not actual savings. So I appreciate the work you're doing and would encourage you to continue to do such a good job.
Thank you.
Any further questions? And thank you very much. All right, have any of our member sponsors, any legislators in the room? Yeah. You can go in there. So I'm going to close the informational meeting on the Oregon Education Benefit Board. And I think what I am going to do is we have several members that want to come and speak to us about our bills. All right, I'm going to open up, yes, Ms. Representative Maurer.
3246 is... but that's the speaker's side. Right.
The speaker's bill?
Yeah.
Yes.
You drive one. I'm sorry.
That's good. I think I'm going to open all three of the OEB bills because we have the same people signed up for all of them. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2016, House Bill 3239, and House Bill 3246. Kevin, can you give us an overview of each of those, please?
Yes.
Poor Kevin.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, three bills will be going 2016. This measure permits a community college district to use established district policies, procedures, or practices, as well as terms of a collective bargaining agreement to determine an employee's eligibility to participate in a benefit plan offered by OEB. Next, House Bill 3239 is before you. Provides that a common school district may request that OEB allow the district to offer its own benefit plan. Provides that if OEB refuses to allow a district to offer its own benefit plan, OEB shall pay for an independent actuary to conduct a study that compares the cost of the benefit plan provided by OEB to the benefit plan offered by the district. That provides that if OEB and the district are unable to agree to an independent actuary to conduct the study, that OEB and the district shall submit the issue to binding arbitration. If the study concludes that the benefit plan offered by the district is of better value to the district than the benefit plan provided by OEB, the district may opt for the benefit plan provided by OEB and offer its own benefit plan. And then finally, House Bill 3246 provides the requirements of ORS 43886 regarding self-insured districts with independent health insurance trusts have premiums for benefits that are equal to or less than premiums for comparable benefit plans provided and administered by OEB, that those become effective on August 1st, 2013, as opposed to August 1st, 2010. And those are three bills.
Thank you very much.
OEB.
And Representative Edwards is in the room.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm State Representative in House District 14, representing West Eugene, Santa Clara, and Junction City. I'm pleased to see that we've filled the committee room in awaiting my testimony on this great insurance bill, so this OEB bill.
You're very popular, Representative Edwards.
I know.
We did, Representative Edwards. In fact, we had a hearing the other evening where we had a witness whose name was Chris Edwards, and he referenced his wife whose name was Allie Edwards.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
Oh.
We can all verify.
I better find out what that guy's up to.
It was a little shocking.
That could create problems for me. So I bring you House Bill 3239, and this comes. I bring this to you because of an issue that my local school district, the Bethel School District, is having with the OEB insurance plan. As you know, or as you may or may not know, I voted for the OEB plan. I think it's a good plan. It's saving our state money. But there are instances where local school districts would be forced into a plan that would cost them significantly more. And my district is one of those districts. And we're not talking about tens of thousands of dollars. We're talking about over $1 million if they're forced in into joining the OEB plan this next year, which we are working. We are working with OEB and we are trying to seek a solution that would accommodate my school district. But nonetheless, we certainly have brought this bill forward at the beginning of session, and I want to continue that conversation. This bill would do a couple of things. One, if OEB desires the school district to join OEB against the desire of the school district, OEB must pay for a third-party consultant to conduct a comparability study between the OEB-offered health plan and the health plan secured by the school district. And those studies can be costly, and my district is very confident that their plan saves them money, and it has saved them money in comparison to the OEB plan, and they just simply don't think that it's right, nor do I think that it's right that the burden would be on them to pay for a study to prove such. Secondly, if OEB and a school district cannot agree on a third-party consultant to conduct the comparability study, then the two would seek binding arbitration. Once a third-party contractor has completed a comparability study between the OEB plans and a school district plan, school districts would be allowed to opt out if their plan is shown to be of better value than the OEB plan. And finally, if a school district requests to join OEB, then, of course, they would be allowed to join the pool. Now, one thing that this bill does not express, and it is a legitimate concern of OEB proponents, and I don't think that it's good public policy to allow school districts to jump in and then jump right back out, and jump in and then jump right back out. And should this House have the good graces of this committee and be scheduled should this House bill have the graces of this committee to move forward, I'd be happy to address that in the language of this bill. I anticipated somebody from my school district would actually be here to provide some more details of exactly the situation they face. It's my understanding that nobody is in the audience today from my school district. We have testified at another hearing on this earlier in the legislative session, and I appreciate you conducting this hearing, Madam Chair, because it is an important issue. And in this time, when we are stretching our dollars and doing everything we can to fund our critical services, it is really incumbent upon the legislature to step back from the politics of the issue a little bit and take some common sense and use some common sense in allowing local school districts that want to save some money to be able to do such. And so I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and on behalf of not just my local school board and not just my local administrators, but also my local teachers who really, really want this bill, I thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edwards. Are there questions for the representative? Representative Roland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we agree on an actuarial. The board pays for it. It comes back and says that you will save money in OEB. Then they just will love to go. Or do they want to then have a bill that says, even if it costs a little bit more and we still like ours better, we get to stay on?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I think that it is probably fair to say that some of these issues get wrapped in a struggle over control from time to time, and it's not just about dollars and cents. I think it ought to be about dollars and cents, and so I cannot guarantee that people would just say yay and just jump right into the pool because an actuarial study shows that they'll save a little money. But if they are going to save money by being in the OEB pool, then I think they need to go into the OEB pool, and that's why I supported the bill in the first place.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So let's flip it and say why would OEB want to require, why not OEB per se, but why would the state of Oregon want to require a school district to pay more to provide health insurance to its employees? I mean, I'm trying to think of, I can't drop the politics and say, it's just politics. Well, it's not. It is a dollars and cents issue. Mm-hmm. Why would the state of Oregon, we're not talking nickels and dimes, we're talking tens of thousands, we're talking millions of dollars for school districts and employees. Why would the state want to do that?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, I'm not sure if that's a question directed at me or a rhetorical question, because I think we're arguing partly the same thing. The idea of the pool would be that we get the healthy folks from the Bethel School District that cost less money into the pool, supposedly, to help bring down the cost for everybody, supposedly. And I questioned my administrators at length on this issue about, well, why are premiums in the Bethel School District so much less? Is it because you have a younger than average teaching staff, the claims they simply cost less to insure, the experience rating is less, and they've told me that no, in fact, that's not true, and they claim that they have a very aggressive teacher education effort and health education effort among those folks in their local plan, and that they work very hard and very diligently on prevention. And so it has been something that has really intrigued me, why this district could have that much in savings, you know, over $1 million annually. I mean, that's a big chunk of money.
What would incentive Bethel School District have when they jump in the pool to continue with their wellness program? Because Bethel School District is not going to impact a pool of 165,000 people. Why would they want to continue it if it costs them money and they don't get reimbursed? Because the rate's going to be the same regardless of what they do.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I thank you once again for the rhetorical question that makes my point.
Are there further questions for Representative Edwards? Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chair Gelzer. Representative Edwards, in your research, did you find any other school districts? I had heard that previously that Bethel had a negative adverse impact. Did you find any other districts in the state that had the same consequence?
Madam Chair, Representative Comp, there are other districts. I don't know exactly which all the other districts are. I know that although there are several of us in the legislature that are working on behalf of our districts, I know the Beaverton School District has been one. I think somebody in Clackamas County has, but I'm not absolutely positive which school district. I'm not that familiar with that. With the districts in that area of the state, and there are other folks. I don't know, frankly, why school districts A and B and C why they cost less, and if they cost less for different reasons, I don't know that. But the financial reality is big and substantial for these districts.
Thank you.
So,
Representative Edwards. You had mentioned in the beginning of your testimony that there had been ongoing discussions with the Oregon Educator Benefit Board. Is there any way that this problem could be addressed in rule, or do you believe that there really does need to be statutory change to protect the financial interests of the Bethel School District?
It would, Madam Chair, it would not be the preference of my local district that it's worked out in rule, but sometimes you work things out however you can get them worked out in this building, as you know. And so we're working with OEB right now to see if there is a rule fix to this and to see if that could be done, and then the need for this bill would be mitigated.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Having answered Representative Comp's question about other school districts, do we have any idea where the breaking point is that would defeat the purpose of the OEB? In other words, how many school districts can opt out where it impacts the ability of the collective to make cost savings for other school districts?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, I don't know where that breaking point is. It has been told to me, and I don't know who else is scheduled to testify at this hearing, and maybe somebody more qualified than myself, perhaps folks from OEB, could share some of that information with you. I don't know what that point is myself. I have been told that OEB is saving the state money. And so, you know, the folks that aren't in yet, not having them in would not be, it would not be, I mean, there are savings already realized,
mm-hmm.
So you're looking at the last tier of folks that don't want to be forced in. So.
Okay, thank you.
Any final questions? Representative Maurer, and while you're thinking of your question, that sound is the sound of a cell phone transmission. So if you have one and it's not all the way off, please turn it off.
Probably a BlackBerry.
Yes.
iPhones don't do that.
Although we have no research to substantiate any of this.
I think it's the computers.
It is not.
I think it's the extraterrestrial beings that are.
I won't ask you another rhetorical.
Well, I think the good representative from the health care committee that knows a heck of a lot more about insurance and health care than I do.
PEB has 120,000 lives, I think, and somewhere that includes dependents and employees. And now we're looking at OEB has got 165,000, and the issue is about the pool size. And is Bethel School District, whether it's in or out or whatever, going to make a difference to the pool? I think it would be unreasonable to expect that many districts that are in it would want out for a number of reasons, because they're in it, either they were pulled in it or they saw a great deal. They saw a heck of a deal. Let's go for it. And I think a lot of the districts, it's about how they manage the negotiation and how they manage their employees. Bethel School District, I didn't know it about their wellness, but if you actively manage it, I think you can work to lower those costs. But a lot of school districts or districts and community colleges don't have the expertise to negotiate with the insurance companies about getting the lowest cost. So I think the ones, the Beaverton School District, which is a huge school district, that wants to stay out, and it would cost them a substantial amount of money over the next couple of years if they went into this. And it's because they manage it very tightly, and they negotiate very well. So I just don't see how this bill is going to affect the school district to say, we're out, we're going to go on our own, because the collective bargaining unit wouldn't accept it if it costs more. They want to go where they get the best deal. I just have no idea. Management's not going to want to pay more. I don't see where the downfall is. We've skinned the cat, said here, this is it, and to some degree it's working very well, but there's some places that aren't. And, you know, why would we want to put a noose around someone's neck just because we think we can? We have an opt-out here. It's essentially an opt-out. It really isn't a true opt-out, but I think it gets us a long ways.
Representative
Revlin?
No.
Okay.
All right.
And Madam Chair, we do have someone from Beaverton School District.
Well, we're going to go through. We've got people signed up on the testimony sheet, so we'll make sure we get everybody. Are there any further questions for Representative Edwards? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we have Karen Smith and Tim Witcher. And if the representative from the Beaverton School District wants to come up as well, this would be the appropriate time to do that.
I don't think she heard.
She didn't hear you.
If the individual from the Beaverton School District would also like to come up in this panel, that would be the appropriate time to do this. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Smith, and I represent the Oregon Community College Association. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 2016. It's a bill that we came forward with to clarify the statute with regard to who has the authority to make eligibility decisions. We do believe it's a clarification, and we did have it very narrowly drafted to apply only to community college districts. As you might be aware, community college districts are not mandated to participate in OEB, but once they opt in or choose to opt in, then they are in forever. We do have, of the 17 community colleges, 13 chose to participate in OEB. One has one employee group that is participating. The rest of their employees chose to stay out. And we have three community colleges that offer their own insurance plans at this point. This provision would add a provision to the statute that would allow documented district policies to be used to determine eligibility for OEB. Currently, the statute focuses on collective bargaining agreements and OEB rules for making those eligibility decisions. We've been through numerous discussions with the OEB board about this, and we're assured that the intention was to allow community colleges the ability to determine their employees' eligibility either through a collective bargaining agreement or through documented policies or contracts that they have with non-representative employees. And what we would like is to make this absolutely clear in the statute that the intent of the OEB board that has been expressed to us in writing and verbally and also is reflected in the current rules, we would like to urge and ask that this language actually be put in statute. We do have a number of community colleges that are not represented by labor unions and are not subject to collective bargaining agreements, and so this would make that absolutely clear that we can use those documented district policies in those cases. Also, not all collective bargaining agreements deal with every single aspect of eligibility, and so we want to ensure that the documented district policies can be used to help clarify those situations and go through those criteria. We did have a case where this arose, that OEB has a rule regarding the eligibility of domestic partners, and they have a six-month waiting period before an eligible employee can enroll a domestic partner. Several of our colleges actually have more liberal policies where they allow the immediate enrollment of domestic partners. And this became an issue with one of our colleges who had an employee who tried to sign up their domestic partner, and it was kicked out of the OEB system. We had to go back through the appeals process to clarify the situation, that this person indeed, based on district policy, was indeed eligible to enroll their domestic partner. So for us, it's clarifying, it's making the statute absolutely clear for the future when we have a different board that, you know, may not have the history of this, that it's absolutely clear that the documented district policies can be used for eligibility decisions.
Thank you very much. Please.
My name is Debbie Johnson, RN, and I'm the Health Resource Coordinator for Beaverton School District. We are in support of Representative Edwards' bill and also Representative Speaker of the House Dave Hunt's bill, 3246, when that comes up. Representative Maurer already eloquently spoke about the things that Beaverton School District has done as a large district to help contain costs. We are participating in OEB in the comparability analysis, and we have testified before the Senate Education Committee and the House Healthcare Committee to explain why we are in support also of Senate Bill 901 from Senator Bonamici from our district. So we are in support of those measures that help keep things clean, and for those districts that are not comparable to OEB to not be mandated into OEB if they're managing their services effectively.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Witcher, and I'm the Director of Business Operations for North Clackamas School District. I'd like to apologize in advance if I get out of protocol, because this is my first time before the committee.
Well, welcome. We're glad that you came to us.
Thank
first.
You. I was also admonished by my superintendent, Ron Naso, to behave myself. And yeah, and what did I say? The quote was, go easy on OEB, so I'm going to attempt to do so. I would say to you, first of all, I'm with North Clackamas. We're the fifth largest district in the state. We've been self-insured since 2000, the year 2000, and our plan has been a plan that has been largely successful over time. We, like any other plan or any other economy situation, have had bumps in the road. We've made adjustments for those things, and we believe that what we have right now is a fairly well-oiled machine. Our concern is with House Bill, our advocacy is for House Bill 3246, although I would echo Debbie's sentiments about being in support of those other bills as well. But specifically for 3246, our situation is that since last August, we have been attempting to get information about the specifics of the comparability study that we would have with OEB so that we could prepare for these things, so that when sometime in the spring, we assume, of 2010, we would be prepared to make the appropriate comparisons. No fault of their own, because they were busy in the throes of getting the program up and running. We were not able to get very good, solid information about exactly what was going to be in the comparability. We've not gotten good actuarial information about what's going to happen. We have not gotten information about when, necessarily, the comparability is going to occur. Our concern is that while we have worked very diligently since 2000 to have a solid plan, we need some time after these things are put in place to actually do the comparisons in a kind of methodical way. Number two, and this is the part that I'm going to say, I'm probably not going to be on Representative Maurer's Christmas list. Our concern is that while there's a lot of hubbub, and probably rightly so, about OEB and the programs that have been rolled out, we're dealing with a situation that we've been in existence since 2000 with matured claims. We're having a situation right now because of the time frames that OEB has come into existence where they're not matured yet. So we don't really have a good handle on what's actually going to happen as the plan matures. The situation with the 2010 deadline says that before we have good information about that, and we've had a couple of full years of matured claims to see what actually happens with the rates, we have to make a determination. If that determination is made then that we are not viable, then we're not allowed to stay out of the plan, and once you're in, you're in. So what we're saying with this, with the extension of the deadline, it's not that we want to stop the progress that's being made, not that we want to stop the benefits that have been had statewide. As any other situation, one size fits all does not necessarily negate the Bethels of the world, the Beaverton situations of the world, but our concern is that we need enough time with good data, with a set of, any actuary that you talk to will tell you that you need a minimum of 24 months of matured claims before you can make a good determination about a plan. And the time frames that we would have to be going into OEB sometime in the spring of 2010 would not give us those 24 months at a minimum. Further, when we get into the comparability study, one of the things that's a very big concern for us is it looks like a year-to-year comparison to determine whether or not we're allowed to stay out of OEB should we be successful. We believe that's like looking at your 401k every year and deciding whether or not you're going to save. This is a long-term situation. When you're in self-insured insurance, you're in a long-haul kind of investment strategy. There should be a longer time of rolling 3 year or something like that, comparison being made of period once we go to that place. But right now, we don't have all the detail. We don't have an exact timeline. All we know is that sometime in 2010, somebody's going to tell us if we're good or not. And from our perspective, that is too soon. And we would like for the plan to be able to be matured and have matured claims so that we have a good handle on what we'd exactly be getting ourselves into, as opposed to being thrust in there in sometime in 2010 before matured claims have been had.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do.
Representative Mallory.
Right. Sir, actually, you are on my Christmas list. if you were to go into or forced into OEB this year,
yes.
Can you tell us an average, how much would, what's the difference in price between the OEB comparable plan and what your district is doing today?
That's a very, very interesting question. It depends on how you rate us. If you rate us on a composite basis, we save money under our plan. Our composite rates are lower than the composite rates in OEB. If you compare us on a tiered basis, we're more than, which is part of what our concern is, because actuarially speaking, what should happen if you were to take either the tiered rates or you take the composite rates, you should come to about a revenue neutral kind of a place. But if you took our population base, and right now we have about 2,713 lives that are covered under our plan. And if you look at the rates that we have now, if you look at on the tiered rate basis, OEB, well, first of all, let me be clear. OEB saves money over our current plan, which is like comparing not apples for apples in terms of the benefits, even though we're making modifications. But even right now with a plan with ours that is a superior plan, just from the standpoint of the benefits that are allowed, if you took us on a composite basis, we would be less money. So it's a very strange situation, which is part of the reason, quite frankly, we'd like to stay out and let the dust settle and find out, are the tiered rates really the real deal or the composite rates the real deal? Because from an actuarial standpoint right now, they can't both be, and we're not sure which one is right. So a part of our thing is to stay out of the fray until that gets settled. And when the matured claims come into being and the carriers that they're currently using have to adjust some of their rates for the real world, we'll have a better understanding of what that is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Ms. Johnson. Same question. Compare OEB rates versus what you're paying. And because you're self-insured. No, you're not.
No, we're not self-insured.
You're not self-insured. Go ahead.
With our data that we submitted
to the Education Committee, the Senate Education Committee, it looks like $8.6 million difference. And that's on, and we always use composite rates. So we will be, we have submitted that to OEB, and OEB will be hopefully sharing with us probably in May, mid-May, if our rates continue to be lower than their rates. As we're looking at our renewal, the majority of our rates are still under their current rates. So even with our, we're very blessed in our renewal, that we're still under, in the majority of our plans, under OEB right now before they get their renewal, which they're going to get their renewal at the end of April, first part of May.
Thank you. Representative Reblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if you stay below, then you don't have to get into the program. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's part of why Senator Bonamici is working on Senate Bill 901, because she found, it, with help of legislative counsel, that the comparability language falls out of the original, was it House Bill, Senate Bill 426? Senate Bill 426 of the original bill that became OEB. So she found that it falls out, so she's putting it back in the comparability analysis. But there's nothing in statute, and that's been our, that's why we've been down here so often this session, is because there's nothing in statute that tells OEB that they must waive us. It just says in their own administrative rules, which they recently came up with, I guess last month, that was done in private, in executive session, not in public hearing process. So they don't have to. They have been last year to, but we didn't go through comparability last year. But we hope that we do get a letter saying that we do not have to participate because our rates do not. But that's why we want it in statute. That's why the districts who are not in OEB want it in statute.
Other questions?
This is actually for the Clackamas one. Your concern is that you don't have the data yet to say whether you're comparable, and you've got these, this discrepancy between the two different groups.
Yes.
So you could go another, in the one bill, it puts it out for a couple more years. It would give you that data. And so if you find out in that time that it would have been better to have gone to OEB, mm-hmm. Then you would say, yeah, we probably need to be in. But I mean, the hard part there is if I'm a school patron and I find out that it cost the district an extra $200,000 or $300,000, that was four or five teachers that were probably laid off in between while we're waiting to find out. That's a tough one, too. So, I mean, this is the one that's balancing, no?
No. Okay. If I can correct, what's happening is most districts have caps. They've negotiated a cap. They don't do a percentage of premium, but it's a cap. And so it's not that that the school district's going to pay.
It's the employees.
It's the employees.
Is that the case in Clackamas?
I was going to say before, and he's right, most of them do. We do a percentage.
Okay.
You do a, and let me tell you why we do a percentage. This has been a philosophical discussion back when the superintendent was going through negotiations several years ago. And the concern was that if I'm a single person and I'm there and I'm doing what I'm doing, I don't care about what happens with the premiums because I just, I'm single, one person, and I get to pay nothing. So the intent was with ours was, even though we are on a percentage basis, is that everybody would have some skin in the game, for lack of a better term. I will say this to you, though. As when you talk about the concern about being a patron and those kinds of things, there are several factors that you need to keep in mind. Number one, OEB is still out there. So the comparable costs are always there for us to look at as a committee. Number two, the situation is, if we were to prematurely, because of just looking at one side or the other, let's say we looked at the tiered rates, we jump in. The problem with this is going back to what Representative Edwards was talking about jumping in and jumping out. Once we're in, we're in. This is like the firm. Once you're in, you're there. So our situation is, what we'd like to do is find out if this is actually going to be cost-effective for the long haul, because what I will say to you, respectfully, sir, would be that what we'd be looking at is a situation where don't make us come into a program that does not have long-term sustainability. So what I would say to any one of my patrons out there is to say, well, look, if we are a dollar higher than they are right now, we'd ask for your indulgence, because what we're looking for is for 10 years down the line to be in the right place, not next week be in the right place.
One more follow-up.
Yes, sir.
And this can be to either on this one. Do you, when you're considering your comparables, consider the amount of time that personnel are spending on keeping that insurance the way it is that we might not have to if you're in OEB? So how many people hours are being used to keep the negotiations, getting the insurance stuff, and so on, that may not have to be there if you're covered by OEBB?
I don't think there's a savings. From our part, we run pretty lean. I'm the only benefits person there, and there's one enrollment classified person as well. So we actually feel more comfortable running it ourselves, and with the relationship we have with our associations and our district insurance committee, we run things pretty tight and pretty lean. So.
Okay.
From our standpoint, I would echo what she's saying. From our place, there are people that are doing their enrollments for benefits. They would either be enrolling in the OAB, they'd be enrolling into the self-insured plans. We have third-party administrators that handle the majority of some of the behind-the-scenes things, paying the bills, those things. Those are not done in-house. So, it's a pay me now, pay me later. I either enroll you in Kaiser or I enroll you into our self-insured plan. Once I'm putting you in the system, it pretty much is a wash.
Just a comment to the extent that you would like to know what the long-term impacts are going to be. 195 other school districts like to know that too.
Just in response to that, I do get that concern,
right.
And I feel bad for them, but I don't want to be one of them yet, frankly. And the other situation is, we took some of the pain in 2000 because there's this. I don't know if people really understand what it took to become a self-insured entity to start with. And so when you take the responsibility to do that and you take that on at the beginning of the process, in some ways this feels like it's potential kind of a payback for going through the, because it would have been just easy to pay a premium. I will tell you there have been several instances, and I can think of one specifically, with our dental. In about 2006, we went to a non-refunding retention contract, which is a quasi-self-insured model, probably not too far away from what Beaverton is doing with their insurance piece. And we had the same carrier, same people, and the same plan that had been experiencing increases every year. All of a sudden, our teeth got way better, and we had no increases for 3 years. So those kinds of things also have the potential to have paybacks in that they have to give you information about your specific pool of people, and you can make the adjustments, because in our district, for instance, if we know that there's a specific undercurrent of some things going on in our district, we're able to target it, much probably like Beaverton and some other ones that are being successful with it. But I do understand where you're coming from.
Young colleagues, we're going to have to move on from this panel. We have one more on this bill, and I think we have a few people in the room that are interested in the next bill we're hearing today. Thank you all very much for coming and making the trip to Salem. Justin Black, Tricia Smith, and Rob Wagner, please. Welcome.
Thank you.
We have all three of the OEB bills open, 2016, 3239, and 3246.
Hi, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Black. I'm from the Oregon Education Association. We represent upwards of 48,000 members in the K through 12 community college education ranks. They range all over the spectrum in there. The majority of our members are now in OEBB, with the School Board Association deciding to no longer deliver insurance services. The majority of the district decided to go in, hence most of our members also went in. Our members are very happy so far. There are some issues that we've had to deal with OEB over, provider networks and such, and OEB has been very good about expanding its provider network to meet our members' needs and to look at changes like that. I want to highlight a couple things that Ms. Hall said from OEB. You know, the amount of savings that our members and school districts are seeing, you know, upwards of $37 million just this year alone. Districts are saving between 1% and 18%. The great thing about the comparability issue is that a district will not have to go in if it's going to cost them more. I think Bethel is proof of this. Bethel went through the process this last year, found out that they were saving money with their current plan. They were not required to go into the pool. I think that shows that the system is working as it is. Let's see, I will go through these bills one at a time. House Bill 3242, which is the one that extends the timeline for self-insureds to look at OEB. You know, the perspective we come in is that Representative Mauer is correct. It is really, to a large part, our members that are paying for this. They negotiate a cap with the insurance company, and then if you go over that cap, it is our members that kind of foot the bill. What we're hoping is that this will allow self-insureds, or speaking against it. What we like is that our members are able to look at comparability every year so that they know they're getting the best deal possible for what they're spending. And what we've seen in a number of districts like Salem is they found out they were saving money. Now they're actually below their cap. So not only are our members saving money, but so is the school district. We think that self-insured districts should go through the same process. And North Clackamas is currently in going through a comparability study, kind of a run through, a dry run through. It won't have any meaning, but it is a chance for them to look at if their plan is comparable or not comparable. My understanding is that OEB expects to have results of that very shortly so that North Clackamas will know kind of the results of that. The next bill, House Bill 3239, which is Representative Edwards' bill, I want to come on touch on a couple points. OEB has invested quite a bit of money so far in their actuary. I don't think that no one has said that their actuary is unbiased. Their actuary doesn't make any more money if a district comes in or doesn't come in. In fact, no one at OEBB makes more money if a district comes in or stays out. They make the same money as they always make. But this, by going out again and having to do a new RFP, find a new actuary, you know, will just basically cost shift to districts that are already in OEBB to kind of support this comparability plan for some districts to find out whether or not they also have to join. The last one is House Bill 2016. Also want to speak against, you know, this is already the practice of OEBB. We feel that this is an unnecessary change to statute. We want to make sure that there are not barriers to part-time members and to other members in the community college ranks to getting the benefits offered by OEBB. And I will close with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Rob Wagner, representing the American Federation of Teachers. I'll keep my testimony limited today because I have a feeling you've got dozens of people here on an issue around tuition equity. I'm not even going to come back and testify, but I will say that it's a great bill, and we also support the Federal DREAM Act as well. So for those that are out in the wings. In terms of OEB, we also are in opposition to the three bills that you have before you today, 2016, 3239, and 3246. I won't echo too much of the testimony that we've already heard from my counterpart here. I'll keep my testimony limited to 2016 and a little bit of the history of the issue. Back 2 years ago and also 4 years ago, there was some conversation with the community college folks about concern about whether or not bringing OEB online, even if it was a voluntary opt-in for community colleges, would require them to have to pay and pick up health insurance coverage for certain classes of their employees. We testified then, and it's still the policy today under OEB, that that is determined by board policy or through collective bargaining. The class of employee that gets coverage through OEB. So the bill before you with 2016 really is not needed. It's what OEB is already doing. You already heard from Ms. Smith that 13 and almost 14 of the 17 community colleges have decided to opt in. They weren't mandated in, but they decided to opt in because of the benefit level provided under OEB. I was just talking to one of my counterparts at PCC who said that OEB was a lifesaver for PCC. In fact, there were 600 part-time faculty that were teaching better than 0.5. So these were folks that are trying to make their career out of teaching. they were, for the first time ever, because of OEB coming online, were able to offer health insurance benefits to this class of employee. And over 300 of them actually chose to go in into the pool. The Kaiser plan actually came in at less true cost. So again, it's one of those situations where you're saving the college money and the employees are saving money. And before these employees were offered access into OEB, 15% of these members could not even purchase health insurance as a self-insured because of pre-existing conditions. We actually had one member who was denied coverage through a private provider for seeking marriage counseling, literally. So we'd be open to a broader discussion about a statutory mandate around people having access to health insurance benefits in this state. But I will say it sounds like the objection that was raised around domestic partnership benefits as well, it sounds like that got resolved through the board, so I don't see that there's a statutory need here. But if there is the desire to take a look at this bill and come in with some sort of mandate so that districts aren't discriminating against domestic partners, we'd be certainly open to having that conversation as well. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association and its 20,000 members working in Oregon education systems from Head Start through community colleges. I'm also here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2016, 3246, and 3239 for many of the reasons that you've already heard. I'd like to take you back just a bit to the reason we created OEB in the first place. Before there was an OEB, insurance premium rates were jumping up 22 to 25%. I have members who were literally and truly writing their employer a check every month rather than receiving a check in order to have health insurance. And that number was growing every year. More and more of them could not afford their co-pays, could not afford their piece of the premium. As you've heard, there is a cap in most school districts, and so increases were borne by the employees. And many of them, many, many of them, could no longer afford to insure their children and their families for health care. That's the reason we created OEB, because we understood, the legislature understood, that where we could control costs for this group of employees was by pooling them. Many of the districts, you've heard from districts who have very unique circumstances which give them a slightly different picture than most districts statewide. But I suggest to you that that's a temporary picture at best, because health care for everyone is still skyrocketing in cost. And the best we can do is broaden the pool to absorb the costs and to control them and to redirect health care to wellness, to health care rather than illness care. And OEB does that. We would ask you to please leave the system alone and let it come into fruition as it will in 2010. If we need to do something after that, then we should.
Thank you very much. Are there any brief questions for this panel? Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I guess, like I said, we've got 165,000 lives. A number of those districts wouldn't go out because they're clearly saving money. Great. But those districts that are saving money, why would you want to force them into this pool? At some point, they're going to be drug in. There's no way this comparability study has been played with pretty fast and loose, in my opinion, and that they're going to be drug in. Why would we want the employees to have to pay more? Because to me, that just is beyond. I mean, the reason is to save money, really. And then we're asking some employees to pay more. To me, doesn't pass the common sense test. So, comments.
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, I'll respond to that. The goal of OEB is to have quality insurance at the best possible price, and I think Bethel is proof positive that a district will not have to enter the pool if they are in fact saving money.
Follow up. Okay, 10 years down the road, how do we know there's no comparability because everybody's drug in? I mean, there's there's no way that these districts are going to, in 10 years, there will not be a district out of this pool. I mean, I just will flat out say it. And then there's no competition. It's, you now have the captive audience, and there's no way we can compare.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I'll try this one. Representative, I believe that the state of the health care coverage in the United States is such that something must be done long before 10 years from now nationally to deal with the cost of health care in this country and the lack of provision of health services. So I'm hoping that this is a stopgap measure waiting for larger reforms.
Any further questions for this panel? No, thank you all very much for coming today. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2016, House Bill 3239, and House Bill 3246. And I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2939. Kevin.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2939. Proposes some changes for purposes of determining tuition and fees, draws a distinction between those who are considered financially independent and financially dependent. These changes, there are four criteria for each group of either financially independent or financially dependent students that need to be satisfied for an individual to qualify for in-state tuition costs. Again, this measure would first go into effect on the fall 2010 academic session. And I can go through the criteria if you'd like. Otherwise, we can, I know there's...
I think we have a lot of people here to testify, so maybe we'll move forward. Representative Dimbrough, this is, you sponsored this bill. Do you want to tee it off with a few introductory comments?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm proud to be the chief sponsor of this bill, which I think once this is passed, it's going to bring hope and opportunity to a number of low-income Oregonians who have shown that they're willing to work hard, that they're willing to study hard, but they're looking up at a glass ceiling that's keeping them from fulfilling their potential and really contributing to the state the way that we need them to be. And having said that, however, we have two senators in the room, and as a good host, I'm going to defer to them to come up and present the bill. We have President Vin Vivel from Portland State University, who's going to be on the line with us, and we have someone from the Oregon Student Association who's going to speak as well. So that should be the first panel.
So Senator Morse, Senator Nelson, Adela Aguilar, and we're calling President Vivel.
President's office, this is Terry.
Yes, is President Vivel available, please?
Yes, he is. Just a moment.
Thank you. Expecting our call?
Yeah.
Hi, President Vivel. This is Representative Gelser, and you are here with the House Education Committee. And Senator Morse and Senator Nelson are getting ready to tee this off, and we're glad to have you join us by phone.
Thank you very much for allowing me to do it this way.
You're very welcome, and we'll get back to you in a minute, all right?
Sure.
Thank you. Senator Morse, Senator Nelson.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, Northeast Oregon. I'm one of the sponsors of this bill, and you know, the media's here, and I've been having all these conversations with media about making this Republican-Democrat thing and that type of thing, but I never looked at it that way. I'm a Republican from Northeast Oregon, and I support this bill. We have a lot of Hispanic workers in my district, whether legal or illegal, I don't know. I just know that the agricultural community needs them in order for us to get our work done. So how can we treat their children, whether they're legal or whatever they are, in the best manner to make them the most productive citizens? That's how I looked at this bill. I'm the descendant of an immigrant myself. Whether he was legal or illegal, I don't know. He's from Finland. Couldn't read nor write, but he made sure all of his kids had college education. And so then they made, or at least I had to have a college education, too. That was an essential criteria and different conditions, but from the standpoint, this is very narrowly limited. Oregon, you have to have attended Oregon High School for 3 years prior to graduation. You must have graduated from Oregon High School.
You must be admitted to an Oregon university. You must be working toward residency. I mean, this is opportunity. And so that's where I'm at. That's why I'm a sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, which is the Albany-Corvallis area of Linn and Benton counties. I'd like to share with you just a little bit of my personal, and this issue, by the way, it is very personal, and it's very controversial, and it has great passions that surround this issue. In 2003, this bill came forward in the floor of the Senate, and I voted no at that time. And the reason I voted no was, I believe honestly in retrospect, it was an emotional response to the confrontation that I had with the immigration process into this country with my son-in-law, who is a Chinese national. My daughter was working in China. She met Johnson. And they fell in love, and he wanted to immigrate to this country, and in fact they had a marriage date set, and he could not come into this country. And in fact, I engaged an attorney who specializes in immigration law, and that was unsuccessful. And it took an appeal, literally, to the senior senator from Oregon to intervene on my son-in-law's behalf to just get him a visa to come to this country. And quite honestly, when this bill arose, it was in the context of, gosh, if it's so hard, how can we just open the door and allow illegal immigration into this country? Now, where I came to a different conclusion on this issue was, and we all get mail, and some of it is very good mail. Well, I received correspondence from counselors, in fact, it happened to be in the Corvallis School District, and they recounted the history of students that had gone through the school, had great opportunity, excellent students, excellent citizens, and then came to that point of graduation and the door was closed. And the counselor so eloquently was describing the process of counseling these students and then explaining, your opportunity is no longer. You don't have the opportunity to go on and continue your education. And there's just something fundamentally wrong about that when you have students that, through no choice of their own, are in this country. We have been obligated by federal law to educate them in K through 12 for them to perform at high levels and then come to that point. We all remember when we graduated from high school. That was a big event. But as Senator Nelson said, in my family, that was not the end of the road. It was expected to go on and achieve graduate or university college degrees, even graduate degrees. So where I come from on this issue is, fundamentally, it's what's the right thing to do for the individuals that we're talking about, and what's the right thing to do for society. To take a group of people, again, through no choice of their own, find themselves in a circumstance that they are denied opportunity in this country is fundamentally wrong. And so the issue is, what's the right thing to do? And I'm just very honored to be appear before you today with Senator Nelson and with our colleague, Representative Dembro, on this bill. We recognize that it is not an easy issue. We recognize that the federal government has botched it, quite frankly, in terms of having a rational immigration policy in this country. But for these children that are here, we need to think about society and how we can improve society, and you don't do it by denying education. There's not a one of us in this building that would say we should deny the opportunity for self-improvement through education. And that's where we are today. So, colleagues, I encourage your support of this bill. It's not easy. I've received a lot of issues on the other side, and I understand that well, but it just fundamentally is the right thing to do, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Ms. Aguilar.
Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Adele Aguilar, and I am one of the co-chairs for the Oregon Students of Color Coalition, which is an integral part of the Oregon Student Association. We're a statewide coalition of students that advocate for access, equal access to post-secondary education by empowering students and strengthening communities of color. I thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you about the merits of House Bill 2939. House Bill 2939 is often called tuition equity and is an issue that the Oregon Student Association has worked on in past sessions, and we are here today as the requesters of this bill to urge the passage once again. This bill would do the following. An independent student has gone to an Oregon high school for 3 years prior to graduation, or 5 years for a dependent student, and if the student has graduated from their Oregon high school, and if the student is admitted to an Oregon University System institution, and if the student is working towards their residency, then the student receives in-state tuition regardless of documentation status. The mission of a public university is to capitalize on the provision of a K-12 education by allowing inhabitants of a state who meet a residency requirement to have the skills and knowledge they need to contribute back to the state. Residency in the eyes of the Oregon University System, as prescribed in Oregon Administrative Rule 580010-0030, is for people who have maintained a domicile in the state of Oregon for a year or more without being enrolled in college. And House Bill 2939 accords the intent of the system's residency requirements by merely changing the university system's residency requirement to fit all students who have fulfilled the intended purpose of in-state tuition. This bill, in other words, treats all of Oregon's high school graduates who meet the intent of the system's residency requirement equally and equitably. You're about to hear, among other things, stories from students in high school and community colleges. They have all lived in Oregon for most of their lives. They have achieved a primary and secondary education, which is required by the state statute, and they all have at least one thing in common, the desire to go to college. The sacrifice of their hopes and dreams to the barriers they face is unnecessary, to say the least, and is matched only by the loss of their potential contribution to the state of Oregon and its senselessness. We can change this policy and make Oregon stronger. 10 states have enacted tuition equity policies to correct their tuition requirements. In Oregon, the difference between in and out-of-state tuition is quite shocking. For those students who have lived in Oregon at least a year prior to enrollment at the University of Oregon, In Oregon, the difference between in and out of state tuition is startling. At the University of Oregon, this academic year alone, students who have lived in Oregon for a year prior to enrollment, who have not lived in Oregon prior, must pay $19,992. That is three times more tuition than a student who has lived in Oregon 1 year prior to enrollment. And that's at the University of Oregon. Three times more. For students who have lived in Oregon their whole lives but are ineligible due to their documentation status, that's just too astronomically high. Like, it's just not an option to attend a university if you have to pay three times the tuition. This bill would get more students in college, strengthening our university system and our state. This bill is an opportunity to educate more residents of Oregon and making Oregon a stronger, more productive state. Please take this opportunity to support House Bill 2939. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And President Vivel. President Vivel, are you still there?
I'm here, indeed.
Oh, good.
But I forgot to push the mute button. So
we can hear you now.
Yeah, I may be university president. I'm not that smart when it comes to technology. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Vim Vivel. I'm the president of Portland State University, and thank you for allowing me to do this by telephone. And I very much agree with the points made by my colleagues on this panel. As you know, the presidents of the University of Oregon and Oregon State, along with myself, have been supporting tuition equity for the children of undocumented immigrants, and that support remains for this bill, and you have our letter to that effect. When I had the chance to speak to your committee about Portland State just a couple of months ago, you may remember that I mentioned the five themes of Portland State. one of which was to enhance educational opportunity, to ease the transition and create more effective pathways for students to move from K through 12 to higher education, which is precisely what this bill would help do. As you well know, education is the pathway to success, and we are really denying it by charging out-of-state tuition to students who may already have attended many or maybe even all of their years of K through 12 in Oregon and whom the state has already invested so much in. I think firmly that tuition equity is the right thing to do. And because of the declining economy, it's even more important. You now, as a legislature, have a choice to allow students to continue their education or, frankly, condemn them to a lack of education and increase their likelihood of dependence on state services in the future. Federal law, as you know, requires Oregon to invest in K through 12 education for all students, regardless of documentation status. And we wish the federal law would require the same for higher ed. But in the absence of federal legislation, it is incumbent on each and every state legislature to act. Otherwise, we de facto shut the door on many students because the chance of them actually attending and paying expensive out-of-state tuition is slim to none. So both as a university president and as an immigrant myself, I want to tell you that we want these students on our campuses and in our classes, and I urge your support. Thank you very much, and of course I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. We have many, many people that are signed up to speak today, so I'll ask that we keep our questions relatively brief. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, because I'm anticipating that maybe the future people would not be able to answer this, so I'm asking. I've heard rumor that the University of Oregon is suggesting that in passing this bill it would result in a tuition increase. Is that anything you've heard for the schools in your districts?
I have no knowledge, Madam Chair.
No.
President Vivo, were you able to hear? There was a question
about
whether this bill would lead to a tuition increase.
No, I don't see why these would be related at all. There is, of course, likely to be a tuition increase next year, but that's because of the fiscal troubles of the state. And adding these students would not affect tuition.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for this panel? Representative Roblin.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Having been a high school principal and dealt with this on many occasions, I thank the two of you for stepping forward on a deal that I agree entirely with your comments. This is really about doing the right thing for people. And having had the opportunity to figure out some of these other states, and as I look at these blue states, I understand why my counselors did that. Some of these states have had this for a while, and so they would counsel their students that they better start going to New York or going to some of these other places. And some of those people are now citizens who are doctors and lawyers and professional people who actually live in New York and Ohio, and we could have used them as doctors in Coos Bay, Oregon. And they were brilliant students who, if you knew their life stories and how hard it was for them to get where they got at our school, one a young man from Asia, actually from Vietnam, who had to, by himself because his family sent him off to be the hope for the family, go through Laos and end up in a camp in Indonesia and then eventually get to the United States by some people and then go to school and learn a language and excel at our high school and then realize that he couldn't go to school here because he couldn't afford it and end up in New York is a remarkable tribute to what immigration has done to our country generation after generation. And so I thank you both for being here to help continue this ideal that we have set in this country about giving a place for other people to start. So thank you. I just had to say that for both of you.
Not bad for a couple of Republicans, right?
Thank you. And Representative Benjamin, did you have a brief comment? We've got over 20 people.
Yes, I promise to make it brief, Madam Chair. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I'm on the local committee at the high school in Hood River, and I went to graduation this year, and I recognized a number of children who had been in Head Start, and I thought how wonderful it is that they've gone from the 3 years old up to 18, and these kids did not drop out of school. They were looking forward to the future, and I think that's what we're talking about.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
Representative
one
Thatcher.
Brief question for the, I can't remember his name on the phone. President Ebel, thank you. Is there difficulty reaching enrollment capacity at Portland State University?
No, we have lots of students, and that is always an issue that we certainly are have plenty of demand. Some of the other sister institutions do have more space.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Our next panel is Jim Ludwig, Brenda Hallgrimson, and Dee Sutton Velez.
Hi.
Did you just mute President Vivell, or did you go away? Bye-bye.
I'm the life of college president.
So welcome, and if you'll start your testimony by stating your full name for the record, that would be very helpful.
Who's first?
It's up to you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jim Ludwig. I'm president of Oregonians for Immigration Reform. Oregonians for Immigration Reform is opposed to giving in-state tuition to illegal aliens for many, many reasons. First of all, it's contrary to our concept of the rule of law. Second of all, it's the wrong bill at the wrong time. And third, it's clearly in violation of federal law. One of the most important tenets we have as a society is the concept of the rule of law. We expect everybody to obey our law, not pick and choose which ones they like to. This bill would run counter to that. We also have a trust in the state legislature that they'll not only pass bills, but they'll abide by federal legislation. The only people to benefit by this passage of this bill would be people who are illegally in the country. American citizens and legal immigrants would not. And quite frankly, to the contrary, and to take issue with the president of PSU, if you decline income as far as tuition into a university, somebody's got to make that up. American citizens and legal immigrants would have to pay more for their tuition if you reduce tuition to illegal aliens. It's the wrong bill at the wrong time. Right now, higher education is under a lot of pressure to reduce programs, raise tuition, and fees. To give a $13,000 per year discount to people who are here illegally would seem to be illogical in this present economic climate. Oregon University officials have stated recently that they expect they're going to have to raise tuition by $6,000 per year. What sense does it make if they raise tuition by $6,000 per year and this body were to pass a bill that would reduce tuition by $13,000 for people who are illegally in the country? In 1996, Congress passed the Illegal Immigrant Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. In that act, they put a poison pill in hopes that states would not give in-state tuition to illegal aliens. In essence, what that Section 505 stated was, any state that gives in-state tuition to illegal aliens will have to give it to everybody, regardless of what state they're from. House Bill 2939 clearly does not do that. So you had a speaker earlier say that 10 states have passed such legislation. One of those 10 states, Arizona, put a citizen initiative on the ballot in 2006 that overturned giving in-state tuition to illegal aliens. By a 72-28% margin, voters said no to in-state tuition for illegal aliens. California, unfortunately, is a state that continues to give in-state tuition to illegal aliens. In 2005, a group of American citizens filed a class action lawsuit against the state of California for giving in-state tuition to illegal aliens. This court case was heard in September of last year in the California Court of Appeals. The California Court of Appeals ruled unanimously that California giving in-state tuition to illegal aliens, and exactly the same type of bill that 2949 is in violation of that 1996 immigration law. Wouldn't it be prudent for this body to wait to see how that court case is adjudicated before you jump into the same mess? House Bill 2939 is the wrong bill at the wrong time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Committee Chair Gelser and education members. I'm Dee Sutton Velez, a Hispanic American citizen, an Italian American citizen, and an Irish American citizen. But most of all, I'm just an American citizen. America is a melting pot of diversity, so I thought, but not if people keep sneaking in and feeling entitled to benefits designed for the American citizens using racism in order to steal the American dream. My grandparents picked fruit. They slaved in the factories of New York City. My mother, a poor Hispanic, was part of the Fresh Air program, which gave Miss Roosevelt glory while exploiting poor Latino children. This is what we don't know about. We all come from somewhere to this country, often starting from the bottom and working our way, legally so. It's called an immigration process. What message does this send our children when people scam the system, feeling it's their right because of cultural heritage? I now qualify for college tuition, and yet I feel it's not right to have something for free at someone else's expense. Why my children have to pay for this with higher college tuition cost and a loss of K-12 funding. My learning disabled Hispanic daughter, she's a citizen, works full-time, takes three courses at a time due to a learning disability and working full-time, carrying an illegal alien upon her back. This brings such shame to the Latino community, especially for the ones who went through the process, who paid their dues like our family, and are here legally. I took in a homeless American Latina girl from California. She could not get into college because she was from California, even though she went to school in Oregon all her life. And because she had went away for a little while and came back, they wanted to charge her an outrageous amount. Meanwhile, I saw benefits and tuition going to illegal aliens, not even from our country. We're denying our own Latina homeless American citizen here who was living at my house. What message does this send to my 13-year-old son? To short special education services for dyslexia and high function and autism so we can promote culture instead of funding the K-12 education. He explains illegal immigration is like people crashing a club, not paying dues, not filling out the application, yet demanding the membership benefits at the other members' expenses, claiming racism, where they demand the special accommodations. And most of all, what message does this send to our children? To reward dishonesty, promote race illegally so, at the expense of shorting our children in education. We do this to cuts to the school days, loss of classes, the helpers and aides for Title I school districts in rural areas, special education services, jobs for teachers, K-12 funding, millions of dollars lost to our K-12 children, and more debt down the road for our kids to give in-state tuition to illegal aliens. In closing, this state in-state tuition for illegal aliens is immoral because it shorts K-12 education, and it's just plain wrong.
Thank you very much. Please.
My name is Brenda Hall-Grimson. Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. As he mentioned before, in Title VIII, Section 1621, also of the federal code, it says that illegal aliens are not eligible for any state, local, public benefit, including any retirement, welfare, health, disability, public or assisted housing, and post-secondary school, food assistance, unemployment benefits, or any other similar benefit for which these payments and assistance are provided to an individual, a household, a family, unit by the agency of a state or local government or by appropriated funds of a state and local government. With that being said, we are against passing any state for any illegal alien. Number one, it clearly does break our federal laws. College entrance slots are fixed. They're limited. This bill would place each state citizen in direct competition with adult illegal aliens for limited slots and tuition benefits. Giving in-state college tuition to illegal aliens residing in each state would give them benefits not given to any other American citizen in any other state. Again, he mentioned the 1996 federal law, which it mandated. American students have to pay higher tuition. This will also create higher student loans. It puts a heavier burden on the American students. It's not their job to finance secondary education for all adult illegal aliens. Oregonian taxpayers will be paying the difference. This is not right to shift the burden to the taxpayer, endlessly funding people that are illegally in this country. Now, we've heard a lot of sad stories. Everybody has a sad story. I can take you back to my family history and give you lots of sad, sad stories. But the fact of the matter is that we're paying with our taxes not only, you know, education, now K through 12, we're paying different housing, we have, you know, different benefits and welfare and housing, our jail system. Come on. Your job as a committee, you know, your job as our legislator and our lawmakers is to be protecting the American people, to be protecting citizens, be accountable for the money that is received and everything like that. And we're not seeing that. We're seeing special interests and not accountability. It's like this endless money, you know. In-state tuition for illegal aliens will give benefits to adult or nearly adult children over the age of 18 whose parents are also illegal aliens. At what point in time we're accountable. My kids can hold me accountable for anything that I do wrong to them. At what time, I'm sorry, but, you know, maybe that the parents should be held accountable. It's, you know, it's getting absolutely ridiculous. There are over 60 bills in the Oregon House that will raise existing taxes and fees along with creating new taxes and fees. Oregon's unemployment rate has hit 10.8 this month. While many Oregonians are reevaluating their finances, finding ways to get by, tightening our belts and living within our means, and searching for jobs, we seem to have a state government who keeps raising fees and taxes, creating fees and taxes with no end in sight. It's like a state government that seems to think that either money grows on trees or it falls from the sky. Your financial tree is we the people. You are financially hurting the very people that you say that you are helping. We've watched our state government do what they want, costing Oregonians in many different ways. Portland City Counseling, open up a day labor site, costing taxpayers $200,000. Loss of jobs to American workers. Tell that to the 10.8. Americans here in the state of Oregon. We've seen Governor Kulongowski turn around and participate in aided carousels of information. Again, state employees doing, you know, showing how to receive the benefits that are meant for American Oregonians. We have watched where our legislative branch, passed Oregon 181-850, prohibiting Oregon state police and county police and police departments from asking immigration, therefore tying the hands of the people. We have crime that runs loose and everything like that. We watch our voting rights be manipulated and open to fraud. Yet our lawmakers and leaders have openly done so. It's grand that we have a checkbox system, yet the Secretary of State does nothing to verify who is a legal citizen. Sounds like our driver's license issue. I'm sorry if I don't trust the government. I've yet to see a reason why where they benefit the American people or Oregonians, legal Oregonians. This is not a party line issue. We as citizens are held accountable for following our laws. Our state government are not above those laws. We are sick and tired of watching our federal government pass blame to the states while the states pass blame to the federal government. Waiting for the federal government to do something about illegal aliens does not give you the right as our elected officials to continue to openly fund and aid illegal activity with our tax dollars and then tell Oregonians that you're working in the best interest in protecting us. Instead, we seem to see a fat state government continue funding programs that are stretched, are in the red, continue growth in spending. It's time that our state government steps up to the plate and for once puts the best interests of legal taxpaying Oregonians first. And yet the state of Oregon has the audacity to want yet to fund in-state tuition for illegal aliens. We hold you all accountable for not only following our laws, we hold you accountable for what you do with all the money that belongs to the people of Oregon. And the funding of in-state tuition clearly violates our federal law. It also clearly violates the trust of every taxpaying Oregonian.
Thank you very much. Are there any brief questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much. Our next panel will be Logan Gillis, Vidal Fuentes Ramos, and Rachel Cushman, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, Logan Gillis with State Representative Michael Dembrough's office. And thank you for the opportunity to speak today on this issue. I'm going to keep my comments brief. I understand that there are a number of other folks who have signed up to testify. I'm before you today to address some of the legal concerns that have been raised by House Bill 2939. Which Representative Dembrough, as you know, is one of the chief sponsors of. We heard earlier from Jim Ludwick from the Oregonians for Immigration Reform, and I sat down with Mr. Ludwick about 2 months ago, and he expressed these same concerns to me, specifically Section 505 of the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which is the federal law that has been referenced multiple times. And we already knew that 10 other states had passed this bill and that none of them had been struck down. But we asked Legislative Council to review House Bill 2939, to take a look at the 1996 Federal Act, both Section 505 and any other contents of that act, and to render an opinion as to whether the bill was in conflict with federal law. And what you should be receiving shortly here, if you don't have it in front of you already, is a copy of that opinion that we received back. Just briefly to highlight the second paragraph, and I will leave you to read the rest of the opinion, which is very useful as well. But it says, despite a recent California appellate court decision, our conclusion is that House Bill 2939 is not in conflict with the federal legislation. And you can go ahead and read the rest of that yourself. I think there's a good discussion of the California case, which I would note was denied initially, and then the appellate court overturned the denial, and it is now going to the California State Supreme Court, likely to be heard later this year. And with that, I will end the testimony, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, my name is Rachel Cushman, and I am the co-chair of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition and a student at the University of Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you the story of one Oregon student who will be affected by House Bill 2939. I was just over a month old and the youngest of three siblings when my parents decided to move our family to Oregon from a small ranch in Zacatecas, Mexico. I started preschool in Clackamas County and have attended Oregon schools ever since. I've always loved school and have always been very successful. Of my parents' three children, I guess I was the luckiest because I was so young when we moved here and took very easily to learning the language. I learned the alphabet before starting school. Both of my parents worked two jobs while we were kids. They taught me a very strong work ethic, which has served me well. In fact, I juggled school and many extracurricular activities throughout my time in school. In junior high, I was also involved in student council, basketball, track, and cheerleading. In high school, I balanced homework with student council, the snowboarding team, and was part of two different mentoring groups. One group focused on drug use prevention, and the other was for at-risk girls in junior high. Aside from my extracurricular activities, I kept focused on my studies. I was able to graduate a year early as one of our four valedictorians. I was the only woman and person of color in the group. I was also recognized as a National Hispanic Scholar and thought of my college plans often. As a freshman, everyone told me I could be anything I wanted to be. As a sophomore, I became very passionate about the good that I could do working as a counselor or within the social services. As a senior, I received scholarships and acceptance letters. Then I realized what it meant to be undocumented and trying to get into college. The full ride scholarship offers, the acceptance letters, none of those came to fruition. because students without documentation were ineligible. I was devastated. There was no way I could afford school without scholarships and affordable tuition. This time was difficult for me and my family. I felt like I was finished. My family has never been on welfare. We've never received food stamps. We've always been poor, but we've worked hard and made it. All of my hard work almost felt like a waste. Through the help of my family, I was able to work and afford a community college in the Portland area. I graduated at the top of my class with an associate's degree in social work. After finishing my degree, I was back to the drawing board. I would have loved to continue on and transfer to a four-year university in Oregon like so many of my peers, but that was not in the cards. The reality of out-of-state tuition was 100% impossible for me. I just turned 20 and I'm working. I've come up against so many barriers getting an education. I'd always thought I'd just keep going through the school because I'd always done so well. I'm working now full-time while my former classmates have moved on to universities. I want so badly to be there with them, but we can't afford it. Nor can the state of Oregon afford to lose my potential. Please support House Bill 2939 so that students like me can get an education and make Oregon better and stronger.
Thank you very much.
Chair Skelzer, members of the committee, my name is Vidal Fuente Ramos, and I moved to Oregon from Puebla, Mexico when I was 15. My mother left trying to escape from domestic violence and brought me and my three younger siblings. I enrolled as a sophomore at Glencoe High School in Washington County and attended school for 3 years. I graduated with a 3.77 GPA as a member of the National Honor Society. I received a certificate of advanced mastery in business and many other recognitions. I will graduate this spring with my certificate with my associate's of art transfer degree, and my dream is to complete my bachelor's degree in international business at Portland State University. Unfortunately, the cost is too expensive for me to continue, and HB 2939 will make this possible to continue my education and provide better service to our community, which is my passion. That's what I urge you to support HB 2939. Almost immediately after I arrived in Oregon, I have to take a lot of responsibility on me because my father was no longer involved. I arrived, I have held a full-time and a part-time job. With little money and scarce resources, we were left with many bills and a lot of debt to pay. However, with determination, responsibility, honesty, hard work, and putting God and my family first, I have overcome many obstacles. With limited English skills, I work hard to become part of this community. The language barrier was not a problem for me, rather, was a challenge. Even though I was still learning English, I enrolled in French and Japanese classes, and I received various awards from those classes as well. Also, I was the vice president of the Hispanic Club, a member of the speech and debate team, a member of the National Honor Society, and a member of DECA. During speech tournaments held on university campuses, I began to see myself assisting to a four-year university. It was motivating. Also, I was a peer mediator, a school tutor, and a library aide. I participated in student leadership opportunities from technology institutes to serving on a statewide advisory board, the youth advisory team by Superintendent Susan Castillo, which I served for 3 years. We work to provide a student perspective for those students K-12 education and try to obtain the position of a student on the board of education. I have stayed involved in my community college as well and involved with Associate Student Government, the Women Research Center, the Multicultural Center, and the International Education Office. I give in-campus tours, organize and lead on-campus events, tutor and mentor high school students, and register voters. Our state has invested so much on me by providing me a K-12 education, and I believe that that investment should not be wasted because now I can afford going to a four-year university. Community service has been a very important part of my life here in Oregon. Since I moved here, I have contributed over 5,000 hours of community service. I believe that community service is the key to succeed in life, and serving others is the best way to improve our society. In high school,
and Mr. Fuentes Ramos, I'm going to have to ask you to sum up. We've got another committee that's about ready to come into the room.
Okay,
thank you.
I was a volunteer at the Oregon Food Bank every Saturday through the summer, and for one school year, I volunteered for the Oregon Partnership, which was an organization to provide prevention on drug and alcohol abuse. Right now, I'm volunteering for the Cascade AIDS Project, the Men's Wellness Center, and assisting in the outreach program to provide education and providing resources for the prevention of HIV/AIDS epidemic in the Portland area for the gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, and queer community. Through my education, I have learned to better serve our community. I'm very passionate about giving back to my community through service, and I believe I can continue to do this even more with access to an affordable, quality university education. Also, I think about the fact that I could have done wrong, but I didn't.
And I really have to ask you to summarize.
Yes.
Please.
Sorry. And in a position to do great things for the state of Oregon, and all what I need is an opportunity. That's what I ask you. Please support HB 2939.
Thank you very much. thank you all very much. And we're going to call up. We have time for one more person, and you can take 2 minutes. So I'm going to call the next person that's on the list here on the opponent side, Ron Swatea?
Swarin.
So there's another committee that comes in right at 3 o'clock, so if you can do it in about 2 minutes, that would be very helpful, please.
It is a challenge. Commission members.
You look up to it.
I think we're kind of at a watershed era in our nation's history. The issue that's really coming before us now is whether the United States will continue as a nation with its own sovereignty or become a subject to international rights movements, movements of persons from foreign nations wanting to have U.S. rights. I heard somebody mention, actually as Representative Dembrell, that low-income Oregonians were affected by this. Mr. Dembrell, I am a U.S. citizen and a resident of Oregon. I'm a constituent of Oregon. Many people that are not constituents of any U.S. districts are now calling elected officials lobbying on behalf of educational bills very similar to this. There's a federal bill in the Congress now called the DREAM Act. There are quite a number of organizations that are engaged in active lobbying on this bill that are urging non-citizens to call and depict themselves or portray themselves as constituents of a district. They are not, in fact, constituents. So, in our nation's history, the Democratic Party has shown leadership in curtailing excess lobbying and untransparent lobbying and tried to enact legislation that would make lobbying more transparent. President Roosevelt pushed for the enaction of the Federal Foreign Agents Registration Act because American policy was beginning to be lobbied by foreign citizens. President Truman became concerned that certain...
Sorry, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize.
Okay.
Thank you.
Foreign lobbying is not to be accepted as a means of accomplishing legislation in the United States.
Thank you.
by foreign citizens, by any foreign citizen, unless they're duly registered.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your willingness to be speedy with your remarks. Thank you all for coming today. As you can see, we have run out of time, and I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2939. Colleagues will be back on Wednesday for another day with an ambitious agenda and interesting topics. I'll see you then. House Committee on Education is adjourned.